It's time once again for Dialogue Conspiracy with political research specialist Mae Brussel, who for 5 years has shared with us her extensive research into political assassinations and abuses of power in this country. Her program relates the news of the week to emerging evidence about the conspiracy which allegedly maintains by force its control over the legislative, executive, and judicial processes in America. And now, Mae Brussel.
Good afternoon. This is Mae Brussel in Carmel, California. It's Dialogue Conspiracy number 231. It's August 23rd, 1976. It's a nice, warm, sunny day in Carmel, California. I'm going to say a few words today about the flu vaccine. I've been promising to do that to people who've called the house and asked me to make some comments about that, the inoculations that will be delivered shortly, and some people are getting them now. And I want to talk about the Republican convention last week and the provocations in South Korea, and that should about do it with a few other wanderings on various subjects that I do throw in from time to time. My opinion of the flu vaccine is based upon a gut feeling of the administration that's in office, their strong links to the intelligence community, and the studying of the very first persons who were involved in the entire incident. As you recall, the basis of inoculating every person in the United States started when four men got swine flu at Fort Dix Military Base, and one of them passed away. My concern primarily is that if civilian doctors had diagnosed the case, if civilian personnel were handling it, if the swine flu occurred at a civilian hospital, any hospital in the United States other than a military base, and these doctors looked at it and asked for permission from other doctors to examine the bacteria, whatever it was, if they called in other doctors who were not military doctors, I'd have more confidence. I don't believe that the Legionnaire's disease or the swine flu should be handled by the military headquarters in Atlantic, Georgia. I've talked about those federal command centers. I remember years ago when medical research and medical expertise was done by what we knew as civilian doctors before the military took over the country, the military intelligence. And it's only been the last few years that even medicine is co-opted by the military and the intelligence community. Physicians used to study at Harvard or Yale or MIT or Johns Hopkins, or University of California, and very fine medical schools all over the country. I was married 8 years to a doctor. I knew many doctors. I knew the route of doctors and professional people growing up. And the Army doctors were the worst trained. They weren't trained at all. In fact, I was familiar with certain doctors when my husband was in the Army, World War II, and know the quality of the medical care then. Now, people at the hospital of Fort Ord in our area may object to what I'm saying. This is 1967. I'm talking about years back. But I haven't read any great papers coming out of medical research of the military. And I think that the CIA should stay out of all experimentation of medicine and keeping germ warfare at their bases like Fort Derrick, Maryland. And I feel that the headquarters in Atlanta, Georgia should be turned over to a team of civilian people, and that the swine flu should begin to be studied only by civilian doctors, and the military should handle patients who are sick on military bases or in warfare, or the families of military people, and they should be trained where other doctors are trained and not at military hospitals. And I believe that the starting at Fort Dix, I'm very suspicious of it because I know the potential for this administration to use germ warfare, and also I feared it in 1976 because of going into a possible genocide through selective injections and knowing their expertise for studying these things for so long. The second point is that the CIA diseases and CIA murders always have what we call motiveless crimes, killers, never a motive. Everything are senseless killings. In the history of man, there's never been so many senseless or motiveless crimes. And the same way with these diseases, such as a Legionnaire disease, we hear the cause of disease may never be known. Every other kind of disease has a pattern, or it's documented, or it has a name. But military diseases are different. And I remember at 1972, Miami, the conventions down there, that Bernard Barker and Frank Sturgis, Watergate plumbers, had gotten air conditioning plans for the hotel down there. And I've mentioned this before, and that Fletcher Prouty formerly of the CIA and the Pentagon, said that they could put poisons and vapors and kill people or numb their memory through these air conditioning plans. And so when the vaccine, swine vaccine inoculations began to be made, then we had the Legionnaire disease, which I think is not separate and could be linked to the same mother of them all, the intelligence community inoculations and diseases. The CIA has drugs and chemicals for heart attacks, for death, for erasing memory that leave no trace. And they've documented this in testimony, congressional testimony, investigative research on them. And that's why the disease, the Legionnaire disease, is not solvable. It's a combination of chemicals that ordinary doctors haven't seen yet, but the intelligence community has access to these particular drugs. So the swine vaccine at Fort Dix and the Legionnaire disease fall in the same category. They're military controlled, they're military investigated, and the military is handling the decision of what to do to proceed. Now, Gerald Ford has been the best spokesman for the intelligence community all of his life that we have in Congress. He was a member of the Warren Commission. There's a new article in Playboy this month naming Gerald Ford as one of 30 congressmen funded by the Hughes Organization, a conduit of the CIA through the Howard Hughes Organization. Gerald Ford got up at the time of the campaigns last week and said the Congress is a do-nothing Congress and it wastes money and spends money recklessly. And yet, after vetoing about 55 domestic bills that would help people in the United States for all kinds of medical care and benefits that we need so drastically, within 24 hours after the Fort Dix discovery of this swine flu, he asked Congress for $135 million for a vaccine. Now, Congress just gives him everything he wants. They give them every appointment they want. Richard Nixon appointed Gerald Ford. The Congress said, fine. They made Rockefeller vice president, even though he was linked to the CIA and Chile and the intelligence community. Congress said, fine. When Ford's name was linked to drug, to scandals and funding, not drug funding, but other clandestine money that was behind his going into the House of Representatives, and there was very scandals to investigate before he's nominated as the vice president, Congress passed him through fine. So the drug companies, there's four drug companies that have been manufacturing this swine flu. They're large contributors to the Republican Party. The insurance companies are large contributors to the Republican Party. And I think in order to take the business out of this, we don't even know about the health safety, we should demand that no profits be made off of this. In other words, everyone who makes that vaccine should have absolutely no profit from it. They should do it at cost, and that's what they should distribute, and they should not be able to make hundreds of thousands of dollars besides the inoculations. There was an article in the San Francisco Chronicle last week giving the arguments against the swine flu, and I'll run those down for you in addition to my suspicions. It said, other than the original outbreak at Fort Dix, New Jersey, the World Health Organization said there has not been a single case of swine flu anywhere in the world. The second point they made was that the European experts are not following the American leads in undertaking a program of immunization. They don't believe it's necessary, and they're not following it. The third point they made is the result of vaccine testing reported in the June American Medical Association news showed that there's substantial differences between the vaccines that are being made by four manufacturers. Wythe and Park is one, and Davis has a split virus vaccine. And it said that this produced an inadequate antibody response in those aged 23 and under. And the whole virus vaccine made by Merrill National and Merck Shark and Dome produce sufficient immunity for the age group. The Merck vaccine caused a higher incidence of fever. So two vaccines, two companies were not protecting people under 23, and two were, and you wouldn't know which you were getting. They said since 33 different vaccines have been tested so far, it is important to know exactly which vaccine they've chosen. They went on to say there seems to be a special problem in finding an acceptable vaccine for young children. Among children who are 3 years old and above, the vaccine that produced the greatest immunity also generated the worst side effects, including convulsions, so that even though they'd be immune, they have no record of the side effects. They went on, we already know that 2 million doses of the wrong vaccine were produced by Parke Davis. This will account for a 2 million dose shortage once the flu arrives, since the company had already been working on a 7-day week around-the-clock schedule before they discovered the faulty vaccine. And do they get paid the same amount to start over, even though they work night and day to make 2 million doses of wrong vaccine, or do they subtract that from their profits and continue to pay? The taxpayer is going to have to pay twice for Parke Davis to make new vaccine. They went on to say no one yet knows whether women who are pregnant in the fall or who have become pregnant in subsequent months should be inoculated. And that brings up the problem of the women who get vaccine that month and don't know that they're pregnant and what will happen to the fetus. Dr. J. Anthony Morris of the FDA, a highly respected expert on flu vaccines, stated that the effectiveness of the vaccine is probably less than 20%. And speaking of previously produced flu vaccine, Morris pointed out that even though all recruits at Fort Dix had been immunized against influenza, Fort Dix experienced a flu outbreak of alarming proportions, even though they had already been immunized. So the effectiveness of this swine flu vaccine is not likely to be any greater than the previous vaccines. So of everyone who gets the inoculations, 20% will be effective. And then you have to say, considering the genocidal nature of people in the White House and in the intelligence community, will there be large areas of, say, the Indian population, the Chicano population, the black, where the flu virus will come and they will be wiped out? And they'll say that, well, there was this percentage, that 20% lived and some didn't. Will there be a selective survival? Will somebody get a blind vaccine, or will it all be the same kind, a hit and miss? These are the things we don't know, and given the intended racism of this intelligence community and their proven ability to stockpile these germ warfares, encephalitis, and all these vaccines, who will they get the inoculations? What part of town will they get them? Who will be protected? These are the answers we don't know. And if people refuse to get the vaccine, the germ can still be induced into the community, and then the intelligence community or the president can say, see, we told you to get the vaccine, and you get punished for not taking it. So you're damned if you take it, and you're damned if you don't. And I think I personally will probably take it and take my chances, because I think it's something I just will do. I feel that it would be handed down to you if you didn't, and I'm going to take my chances and do it personally. But there is this risk, and certainly I would be very afraid if I were a member of the minority or group that had been singled out through the King Alfred plan or other plans that have been documented for possible elimination. And I would be worried and suspicious, and I am suspicious of it. About another subject I want to get into, about 2 weeks ago I had on my program, A Dialogue Conspiracy, my son, Marvin, who spoke with us for about 15 minutes, shared with you the experience he had when he had acid, which we believe was given to him by an agent of the intelligence community. We named that woman and her husband on the air, and we didn't have time to go into what the county of Los Angeles did by taking his savings and wanting to send him to Chestnut Lodge in Maryland, which is a CIA hospital. And just at the final hour, that was stopped. I stopped that shipping him out of the state. But I want to read a little bit to you. This week, I read about the CIA admitting that they had drugs under the guise of LSD, they called LSD, to induce schizophrenia on certain people. Their excuse was to test people with schizophrenia, but also eliminates some of your most interesting and valuable persons in our society, and it punishes people who go too far in their research. And I read you that article about their admitting that they have the means of inducing schizophrenia. But I want to read you a little more today about what the government does before we get on to, I want to discuss the elections of last week, the nominations rather. The Senate Select Committee to Study Government Operations with Respect to Intelligence Activities had a subcommittee with Richard Schweiker, and I've mentioned the subcommittee before, And they met last November and last December on hearings regarding the John Kennedy assassination or the attempt to kill Martin Luther King. And they barely got their foot in the water, and they closed their committee and hushed up their examinations. And maybe it'll go on to Senator Inouye's committee in the fall. We'll see. But I want to read you some pages, four pages from the committee report. These are from the Subcommittee on Government Actions with Respect to Intelligence Operations. And the testimony goes from the 21 different methods that they could use to get at a person. In this case, they were talking about Martin Luther King. And then it switches to FBI came against people and targets, are those special people who are criticizing the Warren Commission. And this is orders from President Lyndon Johnson to begin reports and photographs and documentation on people who are critics of the Warren Commission. The Warren Commission was formed to find out allegedly who killed John Kennedy. And by 1967, those persons who became researchers and were writing books on the subject or lecturing or going to New Orleans like I did with Jim Garrison and getting into writing articles on the subject became enemies of the state. Mr. Epstein, I'm reading this testimony before the Senate committee, represents the FBI, and it was Senator Mondale running for vice president now who was asking the questions. And Mr. Epstein said there was a meeting that was convened at the FBI headquarters in December 1963. This is 1 month after John Kennedy was killed, to go into Martin Luther King. And the cover story of the allegation was to find out if there was a communist influence in any racial matters in the United States. Senator Mondale asked, what tactics were used against him? And can you list some of the tactics? And the FBI agent said, yes. We asked, can we use colored agents? Would they be of assistance to us in the Atlanta area? And how many would we need? Or maybe we could use anonymous sources placed in the home of Martin Luther King or the Southern Christian Leadership Council. That's a tactic we could use. Or we could use tessers or missers on Mr. King to set up counterintelligence move. Mondale said, what does that mean? He said, tessers are telephone surveillance and missers are microphone surveillance. Then he went on, we could use the possibility of Mrs. King, use her against Martin Luther King. Or we could use disgruntled employees working for him, or former employees that were disgruntled, or acquaintances that were disgruntled. And we could use contacts among ministers. They were colored and white who were in a position to be of assistance. Or could we have information on any shady financial dealings of Martin Luther King to explore to our advantage? Or how about the possibility of placing a good-looking female plant in King's office? And Mondale said, so this meeting was called by the FBI to explore every possibility of intimidating Dr. Martin Luther King. Is that right? The FBI agent said, yes. There are a total of 21 different ideas headed under questions to be explored at our conference. This is page 50 of the Senate committee hearings. You can send for these, what I'm reading to you now, the Senate Committee on Intelligence Operations. This is dated November 18, 1975. 21 different ideas, and you know Martin Luther King was fixed up with a female or females, and they recorded his conversations in bed with these women, and then taunted Mrs. King with those after he was dead. So the operation was not only reported as a possibility, but it was put into effect. Then Senator Schweiker says, Mr. Smothers, early in your presentation, you were talking about activities of the FBI against people and targets you mentioned that were Warren Commission critics and that they were singled out for some special kind of treatment. I wonder if you'd elaborate a little bit more on what kind of special treatment people got who criticized the Warren Report. Mr. Smothers, this is the FBI agent. Well, special attention started with a request for information on them, and the information requests were made by the special assistant to the President of the United States. That was Mr. Watson. And we delivered it to the President. They were the President's direction and at the initiative of his special assistant. We do not know, but our evidence tends to show that it reflects a presidential concern. What came back was a series of monographs and biographical statements. Schweiker said, would this be raw material file, probably? Smothers, yes. It appears to
reflect all of what the FBI had on this individual. Some of them are very brief. One person in question is described as a person who thrives on dissension and causes local dissension and arguments in the community. They talked about his educational background, his marital status. That's a one paper. The next one is a one pager. "We haven't yet contacted these people, Senator," he said. Schweiker said, "I understand you had derogatory material included in some of this without getting into specifics." And the FBI agent said, "Yes. Here's one that reflects a morals aspect. It appears to be a vacuum cleaner situation, though, because it's the same discussion of the alleged morals violation, and on two preceding paragraphs, they noted every traffic fine imposed by a municipality." Imagine private citizens in 1967 who were investigating the Warren Commission and the Warren Report were ordered from the President of the United States, the FBI, to keep track of people, and even every traffic fine and everybody they went to bed with was recorded. Back to the testimony, page 51. Senator Schweiker, "This was an attempt on the part of the White House in this case, a request to the FBI, so we set the record straight. Was this to discredit the people who disagreed with the findings of the Warren Commission, or to use this material against them in some way, or to be knowledgeable about the material in raw files so that you would have derogatory information on the critics of the Warren Commission?" "To be fair, Senator," the FBI agent answered, "I don't think they were asked to make use of it. It was certainly asked, they were asked to provide it, and every indication is that the FBI provided it. They took no further steps to disseminate it. Now, what the White House did with it, we do not know. I might insert there that what the FBI did after they gave the information to the President of the United States, then they gave the orders to the Pentagon and organized crime and the CIA to proceed against these people. And I can tell you personally many ways that they proceeded." Senator Schweiker said, "So that request was initiated from the White House. It wasn't an internal FBI request?" "No, it wasn't. It was from the White House." And Schweiker said, "You became an intelligence target of somebody's, or your interest was investigated if you had strongly disagreed with the Warren Commission?" Schweiker said, "Meaning not you, the FBI agent, but a person became an intelligence target of somebody's and of interest if you disagreed with the Warren Commission." Schweiger went on, "I think we have to ascertain the idea that the material was used in some way. There certainly had been some allegations that this material was in fact used in some way. Whether it was in fact used by the White House or somebody else, I do not know. But I think this is the first time we have an indication that the White House requested such derogatory or personal material. Mr. Smothers, what's your opinion and judgment was the purpose of fermenting antagonism between the Black Panther Party, the Black Nationalist Group?" He changed the subject. And the FBI agent said, "We infiltrated him because I believe we see from the other documents that not insensitivity on the part of the FBI, but outright racism on the part of the Bureau. I think they view it as another neutralization effort, except when it came to blacks, they used the most violent kinds of techniques that were accepted." Now, that was November testimony. On December 31st, Senator Schweiker asked Mr. DeLoach, the assistant under J. Edgar Hoover, about this material some more. He said, Senator Schweiker said, "In the deposition that you were shown, in a letter to Marvin Wasson from J. Edgar Hoover, dated November 8, 1966, this is a quotation, references made to your request regarding authors and researchers of books dealing with the assassination of President Kennedy. Attached are summary memoranda setting forth pertinent information contained in FBI files concerning the following individuals." Then, seven individuals are listed. Some of their files, of course, are not only included derogatory information, but there's sex pictures about them to boot. It also says that this communication was not sent to the acting attorney general. It was sent to the President of the United States. "Certainly," said Senator Schweiker, "there's some kind of a pattern here where somebody is in disagreement with the government, is in a political difference. Then first they do a name check. Then they find all the derogatory material they can. Then they take photographs of them and send it out. I know specifically that Congressman Boggs' son, Congressman Boggs was a member of the Warren Commission, who was killed in Canada. There's a pilot of the plane who lives in Australia who's given out details of their plane crash. But Boggs had these in his possession. He's a member of the Warren Commission. And Senator Schweiker said Congressman Boggs' son testified that the White House passed this material of this nature to him while, and they received it from the FBI. The White House passed it, and the FBI was giving it to congressmen. As you recall, we came across another letter several months ago on another one of the critics' personal files, and I think it was January 30th, 67. And here it's 3 months apart. It's an ongoing campaign to personally derogate people who differed politically. In this case, it was the Warren Commission. There wasn't a pattern to you. Wasn't this standard operating procedure that they were out to get people politically, somebody politically? And DeLoach says, no, Senator, I don't see any specific pattern. You showed me a memorandum of the president, and it's for the FBI, and he wanted all information concerning critics of the Kennedy assassination. Those instructions were shown to Mr. Hoover, and Mr. Hoover complied. And then what the White House did with them, I don't know. Schweiker asked, well, what does a name check include? Does it always include this adverse material in the files of a particular person? Is the material substantiated? Is it unsubstantiated? What does a name check include? And DeLoach said it includes all information on a person in the file concerning that individual, the subject of inquiry. And then they sent it to Mr. DeLoach of the FBI. And Schweiker said, well, you were a conduit in this case. You received this information. And DeLoach said, I didn't prepare the name checks. He changed the subject. The names were given to him. And Schweiker said, here's another memorandum. And it's to Mr. Tolson. And it's dated April the 4th, 1967. And it says, in quotes, in this connection, Marvin Watson called me. That's you, DeLoach. Late Saturday night, and stated that the President of the United States, President Johnson, told him in an off moment that he's now convinced there was a plot in the connection with the assassination of John Kennedy, the Kennedy assassination. And you go on to say, in quotes, Watson requested further information. It would be appreciated by him. Send it to the White House. And they continued to gather this information. They also went into the fact the CIA used agents like Robert Mayhew under the Howard Hughes Corporation for private detective work and had hired Sam Giancana of the Mafia and to kill Castro and John Rosselli. Mr. DeLoach of the FBI said the only reason this matter came up is because of Mr. Watson's remark, quoting the President of the United States, that he thought that a certain agency may have been involved in the conspiracy. Here is Lyndon Johnson sending a message to his private aide, to Mr. DeLoach, that a certain agency of the United States government, not Castro, may have been involved in a conspiracy to kill John Kennedy. And what did they do when they heard that there was this? They began bugging every researcher on the John Kennedy assassination, not to find the agency, but to follow the people that were doing the research. Senator Schweiker said, you testified that the FBI was asked to put out a statement saying Lee Harvey Oswald acted in a singular capacity without any plot involved. Is that correct? DeLoach says, that's correct. Schweiker, the White House was asking the FBI to put out this statement. Is that correct? That's correct. In what time frame did they ask the FBI to put this out? He said, I don't know, but out of sheer speculation, it was 1966, 67, 68. And then the testimony goes on that it was immediately after John Kennedy was killed, within 2 days, that the FBI was asked by the President of the United States to say that the case was closed, that Oswald did it alone. There was no conspiracy. And in 1966, Lyndon Johnson was saying that some agency could be involved in the assassination of Kennedy. And the consequence was that the researchers were bugged, and many things happened. I haven't gone into many of the things that happened to me personally. I'm writing a letter again to Gerald Ford and members of this committee. I'd like to go back to Washington and put a rundown of everything that happened to us after the fall of 1967, after I helped Ramparts with their magazine on the Kennedy assassination and then went to New Orleans to see if I could help Jim Garrison make connections between the intelligence community in the Fort Worth, Dallas area and the New Orleans area. And that's when my personal troubles began. And you can see by this documentation that the President of the United States and the FBI turned over all kinds of material on every researcher that they needed to proceed and know their habits and go on from there. Well, so much for that. I'm sure that in the weeks and years to come, we'll see more and more of these things being released and the total picture of how the President of the United States and the Attorney General of the FBI went out to hurt various writers, investigators, and researchers will be further revealed. Well, I have to do last 15 minutes on the events in Kansas City last week because I took a turning point that is very surprising to me. I didn't believe that Gerald Ford had the resistance to hold up against the pressures that he had in Kansas City. I have no love for Gerald Ford. He was on the Warren Commission, and from the documentation I read you earlier, I have to say I have no love for Gerald Ford. But Gerald Ford went to Kansas City, and I guess this is one of the biggest dramas of my research in the last 12 years, what happened in that city. We had a cast of characters that far outdid any B-movie that Ronald Reagan ever did. We had the giants of the past 20 years in political life, Ronald Reagan, Rockefeller, the grooming of Howard Baker and John Connolly, and they had massive power and massive money and the intelligence community behind them. And any one of them as vice president for Gerald Ford was being pushed, and Gerald Ford saw the pressures there. And he went into this thing with huge demonstrations for Ronald Reagan, and we'll go into that. The J. Walter Thompson Agency that handles the Reagan campaigns and this kind of counterintelligence that, provided there were horns in that arena that were not supposed to be brought in. There were costumes like Let's Make a Deal, these big hats and balloons. There was stampeding for an hour and 20 minutes, way beyond anything that Ronald Reagan deserved. He kept saying, I'm for the little people, and people were crying when he didn't get the nomination or the vice presidencies for little people. And even Herb Cain in the San Francisco Chronicle said the only little person that he ever knew was Mr. Stein, Jewel Stein from Music Corporation, who's 5 feet tall. Nobody does investigative work into Ronald Reagan. There's no indication he's for the little people. And this was an emotional stampede that seemed, for all purposes, that Ford couldn't resist it. Incidentally, in the reign of John Kennedy, it was called Camelot, those 1,000 days that he was president, and the code names of Secret Service were Lancer for John Kennedy and Lace for Jackie, very romantic names, you know, and Kenny O'Donnell, the chief of staff, was Wand. I thought it was funny to see Gerald Ford appointed by Richard Nixon. I think he literally went into a jungle. Did you know his code name there was Tarzan, and Betty Ford was Jane, and chief of staff was Chimpanzee? Well, Tarzan and Jane and Chimpanzee, for all I know, it really came through this time. I think it was great. First of all, Gerald Ford gave a speech, and for all that I picked up, I couldn't follow three stations. But I think he's the only person at the conventions that mentioned any of the past assassinations that affected America. He began a speech right into it. He said something wonderful happened to this country in the past 2 years. And we realize that the 4th of July, and together out of years of turmoil and tragedy, wars and riots and assassinations and wrongdoings in high places, he wanted to go back to the spirit of 76. Of course, kind of that is erased with his ordering that tree cut down in North Korea this week. It sounded good in Kansas City, but the point is that he did mention the assassinations and the crimes in high places. And he did bypass, this is the important thing, he did bypass Ronald Reagan with his links to the CIA and the Howard Hughes community and the same people that are behind Nixon and the intelligence community. He bypassed John Connolly with his links to Lee Harvey Oswald and the Warren Commission and his secret compound in Jamaica and links to the intelligence community. And he bypassed William Simon, who's covered up the IRS scandal, the Hughes organization. If you read the Playboy this month, there's a cool $55 million from the Hughes gaming table unaccounted for, and the IRS closes the case, and including the Bahama money investigation. And Howard Baker, who covered up the Hughes organization for the CIA. Gerald Ford passed all of them up, and I don't know how he had the pressure, how he resisted the pressure. He heard the applause. He knew the entire stadium was for any one of these four people. They were stampeding. He ran right over to see Ronald Reagan. The two of them looked like they'd swallowed a canary, like they had their little secret. And I thought there would be this mass stampede, and I just can't get over the fact that he just leapfrogged them. And I have a vision of him going to bed and saying to Betty, you know, they said his decision was made at 1:32 in the morning. And I could see him just kind of hitting her on the ass and saying, hey, kid, what do you think we should do? And they said, let's take Dole. Because out of my 12 years of research, there's nothing about Dole that links him to the intelligence community. I'm not in love with Robert Dole. He's a very harsh conservative. His voting record is the worst. But it's his conservative view. It's his right to have that, like I have my right to have it, if he feels that's the way it should be. But Robert Dole in no way is linked to CREEP, the Committee to Re-Elect the President. That was that secret office set up after Richard Nixon was in power in 1968. And Robert Dole became the Republican chairman. And he was in Kansas City. And the CREEP organization, Maurice Stans, John Mitchell, and Haldeman, and Herbert Kalmbach, and John Caulfield, and Tony Laskowitz, and Robert Bennett, representing the Hughes account, they all ignored Dole. They treated him just crummy. He said last week on Face the Nation that when they had the inauguration parade, the national chairman for the Republican Party was in the back seat. And Robert Dole made a statement a few weeks ago that when he tried to get to the White House, when he tried to reach them, he couldn't get through. He said he couldn't reach President Ford any time. He said it's almost impossible to get any input at the White House. He said, we've concluded it's a waste of time to write a letter. This is the chairman of the Republican Party before he was fired by Mitchell and that gang. He said, you can't write a letter. You can't get an endorsement. He said, the trouble is there's personal decisions in the White House are being handled by a little power group, and I don't know who it is. That's what Robert Dole said. They also asked him why he defended Richard Nixon at the time of Watergate. And he said very clearly and clear-eyed, Nixon had bad advisors. And this is a quote from Face the Nation. The people around Nixon never acknowledged the Republican Party. I said so, he said, and he felt that Nixon was being used. He said, I felt that those around him manipulated him. And they did. They kept themselves intact so they didn't gain prosecutions or go to jail and kick Nixon out of his office. And that's a fair way of describing it, because Robert Dole represents the old Republican grassroots group that was working in the party, getting a national organization going together, raising his chicken dinners and box lunches and, you know, the pom-poms and the usual route. But the very fact that CREEP totally ignored him, and then I have maybe 2,000 files on Watergate and never a negative about Dole, and I saw him pushed and kicked around, and it was one of these reasons that I knew that there were two branches of the Republican Party. And I wrote it in 1972 in my Realist article. I said there's two parties and they're running side by side, the ones visible and one's invisible, and one represented the clandestine operations. And so that even though Gerald Ford always worked for the CIA, always fronted them in Congress and gave them everything they wanted in terms of the military or swine flu or anything. I don't know whether he was doing this to protect the nation, which he said he wanted to end the divisiveness, or whether he was doing to save his own life, because there was no way that I could see if he had taken any one of the other candidates that Gerald Ford would have lived. And I felt the pressure was on Gerald Ford that as soon as the nominations were over, that one of three possibilities could happen, that Betty would get sick again with her cancer and he would resign because he'd have to take care of his family, or they could go into a counterintelligence germ warfare kind of thing, or escalate a war in the Middle East. And I should have known, with all the money of the CIA, Korean CIA, and the links of Korea to our government and every member of Congress, that the flare-up for a war could have been in Korea and not in the Middle East. I didn't anticipate that, but I know they have the capability of doing it. Today, August 23rd, there's an article that Betty Ford, now that the convention's over, her neck's pain, she's got an arthritic flare-up, that she had a lot of pain and that she had to be helped with therapy, and she's incapacitated and they can't raise her arm above shoulder length, and she seems to be quite sick today. So we still have the vials of the flu vaccine. We have a North Korean incident flaring up, and we have Betty sick. And that's why predictions about the 1976 election are wide open, because if Gerald Ford cannot win against Jimmy Carter, I wouldn't put it past the intelligence community to go to war over a tree. We've gone on to war over things just as stupid two other times, and anyone with an ounce of brains would know it. And the news, I don't know if you heard the news earlier today, but it was on KGO, Ron Owen, that it's been confirmed that Gerald Ford had permission to cut down the tree in North Korea. And that set up an incident where the United States had cameras watching the tree cut down, and two agents went berserk killing, and therefore the entire Korean government is responsible. And these kind of things can be sure to form, cancel elections, form a warfare state, so that anything can happen between November and August. God forbid, I don't know, with the troops over there, as I say, there's all range of possibilities that the intelligence community has used, and I don't think they would be ashamed to use them again if they thought that they would lose the election. Well, there was this convention with uncommitted delegates, intense pressure. And no sooner did they get on the floor than complaints were filed by Bill Williams, with Bill Williams, a special agent of the FBI, that two persons, a woman, Eddie Mac Jones and Marie Goodloe, claimed that they were offered $2,500 cash to change their vote from Ford to Reagan. It outraged Ronald Reagan with denials, but the thing went to the FBI agent, it went to the Illinois authorities, and that kind of a scandal, the very first day, the opening in Kansas City, could have gotten out of hand if there was more money passed around. I think the intelligence community is definitely running on the defensive now, because years ago they could have gotten away with it. They could have funded the riots or bought votes earlier. They could. We know they were planning the riots in Miami for 1972, and we weren't so smart in 1968 in Chicago. But this is a turning point, because every time you go to somebody and you offer them $100 to demonstrate or $2,500 to change your vote, if they will do like these private citizens and go immediately to the governor and immediately to the FBI and Roger and put a complaint for bribery, then the intelligence community can't get away with what it's doing. And this is one way to stop this operation. This is what happened with the demonstrators. I always said that 70% of the demonstrators at these riots were paid by the intelligence community. And it's interesting this year, with people more aware of what's happening, that the demonstrations in Kansas City consisted of a measly 200 people. The yuppies expected 1,000 or more. There were no people being paid to run around nude. There were no bad drugs being passed out. The protesters were ignored by the media. Nothing dramatic was happening. There was no street theater. And I think that's because more people are aware and will turn them in and say, I was offered this money. You can be offered $2,500 to do something by the agency, and you can make $100,000 writing a book. So as long as there's instant book publishers and people are ripe for scandals and exposés, it may be that there'll be turnaround on this story and there'll be more profit in exposing them than being paid for by them. Because even in a depression era, if there's unemployment, there's more money in exposing them and writing the story. And I think that that was important. But you had this convention with Ronald Reagan, who's now 65, unless he's appointed or Gerald Ford is killed. It was his last chance to be elected president, and you had this huge acclaim, as I say, with the horns and the hats. And he left rejected. He's not through, but it was a dramatic moment of a too close call, and I was nervous about it. I say, if one of the two men is dead, Reagan can still be appointed, so I'm not going to celebrate. But you had the drama of Reagan right there on the floor, losing by a handful of votes. And then the giant Nelson Rockefeller, who worked to be head of the Republican Party, he played the role of good boy. The New York Times said Rockefeller played good soldier. He gave the nominating speech for the vice president, and he gave his job away. He was forced off the ticket. Used to say money could buy happiness. That's not even true anymore. With all of Chase Manhattan Bank and Exxon and investments all over the world, the man looked foolish on the television. Nobody listened to his speech. The camera went around, everybody yawning and reading the paper. Rockefeller was forced off the ticket on the left side and on the right side. He was totally ignored as a political figure
he may be important in the financial circle and still wheeling and dealing, but he was pushed off the ticket, and we ended up with Dole. And then we had John Conley, who wanted to be vice president, and the news people were really asking him rude questions even. The New York Times has an article, Conley deluged the convention with questions about his integrity. New York Times never ran stories like that. This is August 15th, 1976. I've never seen articles like that. Deluged with questions about his integrity. A man who was Secretary of the Navy and Secretary of the Treasury and has carried this clandestine money around with him. And then there was Howard Baker on the rostrum giving this rousing speech that Democrats are roving the skeletons of Watergate, and they rattle those skeletons until the bones fall out and it's not going to work. And he says the Watergate is dead and they're rattling the skeletons. And there's Howard Baker, the contradiction, who closed his investigation of the Senate committee by saying he'd only touched the tip of the iceberg. And also, at the same time that he's giving his speech, New York Magazine has a marvelous article by Norman Mailer of the CIA, what the Senate didn't investigate, the Howard Hughes connections, everything Baker didn't do that's still ripe for investigation. And Playboy on the stand this month has the Howard Hughes, the Senate Baker Committee, what they didn't investigate. So that there's exposés coming out across the country on every newsstand, Rolling Stone, New York, New West, everywhere. And Baker's saying it's a dead issue, and they're all laughing at his committee. So with one big swoop, Gerald Ford goes to bed and gets up the next morning and bypasses Mr. Simon of the Treasury and Mr. Baker and Conley, Rockefeller and Reagan. And for that, I think it was a big stroke, and I think we should be grateful for small favors. Well, this is Mae Brussel, Dialogue Conspiracy, Carmel, California. We've time is up. I'll see you next week, and we'll go back some more to Chowchilla Bus, Emily William Harris, and a few other subjects of interest to get caught up. I'll see you next week on Dialogue Conspiracy.
This has been Dialogue Conspiracy with political research specialist Mae Brussel, who for many years has been researching the facts behind political assassinations and conspiracies in this country. Dialogue Conspiracy originates with KLRB-FM in Carmel, California.